second part of the interview with James Schlesinger by William Burr took place in Washington, D.C. on June 27, 1986. The interview is part of a joint effort by the Columbia University Oral History Office and the Foundation for Iranian Studies. Now, Dr. Schlesinger, in the last interview, you mentioned that there was a special relationship between Richard Nixon and the Shah that had some impact on U.S. policy towards Iran. Now, how do you explain that relationship?
Well, I thought I'd mention that. It seems to me that...
that was after the interview you mentioned it.
It seems to me that while Nixon was... out of office after he'd been defeated in 1960, and possibly after he was defeated for governor of California in 62, he did some traveling around the world, and one must recognize that for a defeated politician, courtesies are most welcome. In the case of the Shah, he gave Nixon considerable hospitality, as opposed, let's say, to some of the nations in Europe, and as a consequence, Nixon was steadily grateful to the Shah and felt a personal bond.
Uh-huh. Okay, I can explain that. I have one question about the arms sale issue, which I forgot to mention last time. During your tenure as Secretary of Defense, were you subject personally to pressures from firms that were trying to sell weapons to Iran? In other words, did executives from firms try to convince you or persuade you to extradite certain sales or accept certain sales?
No, because I had very little to do with the defense industry. I tried generally to avoid seeing them, and I only saw them when I had something that I wanted them to do with regard to weapon system, for example, the F-16, F-100 engine combination. After we made that choice, I saw the senior executives, but I did not expose myself. I didn't have the time to waste to listen to their blandishments regarding their wares. The only pressure I got was from the Congress, and most notably from Senator Symington, who was on the Armed Services Committee, and was indignant that I had not pushed the F-15 on the Shah. As I indicated, I did not think I would have taken the F-15 if I had been the Shah, if he had asked me my own judgment about that, but I did not think that the complex logistical trains that were required by both the F-15 and the F-14 were worth it, and therefore I urged the Shah to avoid taking on two new sophisticated aircraft.
So in terms of pressure, do you want people in the services that would feel those pressures are middle-level people in the Defense Department? To deal more with the officials from
the pressures might be felt right up to the top of the services, and indeed, in many cases, will be felt by the civilian secretaries of the service departments. I made it a rule that we were not going to use arms sales as a way of balancing the balance of trade, and that. Arms sales should not be for commercial reasons, but instead should be for very carefully analyzed strategic reasons. But the services were not so constrained by other secretaries of defense, and they sometimes pressed sales purely for commercial reasons.
Now, sometime in the mid-70s, I'm not quite sure about the date, some high-level U.S. military officials made with the Shah put as a U.S. commitment to use a proposed naval base at Chabahar. Apparently this conversation caused a small flap in the State Department, because it was U.S. declaratory policy to have limited naval deployment in the Indian Ocean, with the exception being Diego Garcia, apparently. Do you recall this incident or these discussions?
I recall it vaguely.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, Henry Kissinger, when he was Secretary of State, never chided the Department of Defense for its vigor in expanding our capabilities, and particularly in the Indian Ocean. I'm sure that there may have been reservations elsewhere in the Department of State, but it was not Kissinger's policy to try to seek the demilitarization of the Indian Ocean or anything like it. Some of the people who worked on the regional desks may have felt that to be desirable and may have felt under pressure from the states in the region that tended to support it. After the 1973 war in the Middle East, it was clearly the joint desire of both Kissinger and myself to expand our base structure in the Indian Ocean. That was the reason for Diego Garcia. Most of my recollections go along those lines. With regard to the specific question that you raised, I do recall, though vaguely, that the Navy chose some to exhibit some initiative of its own that was not well coordinated with government policy as a whole. And to the extent there was objection to the Navy's initiative, it was more in terms of its failure to coordinate with the government as a whole than any disinclination on the part of the government at the highest level to acquire additional base rights. We were quite concerned in that period, and particularly after 1973, we were quite concerned about our basing capacity versus the Soviets.
Because I remember one of the documents, from the capture documents that were taken from the embassy, discusses this issue. It suggests that there was some concern about having overt stance towards expanding naval capacity.
Sir?
The document suggests that there was some concern about having an overt stance of expanding naval capacities. I guess we'll take that.
What document is this?
Now, what do you think the significance of those discussions might have been between the Navy and the Shah regarding the Shah of our base? Yeah. That's the part we missed a minute ago. What do you thought? Explain what the nature of the Shah's understanding of commitments might have been.
Well, the Shah understood full well that any discussion between military officials and the Shah had only limited relevance. That the decisions were dominated by the civilian authorities in the United States. The Shah, based upon his own experience with his own military subordinates, knew full well that the military subordinates could not commit Iran, and he would assume the same thing was true of the United States. I have no doubt that there were exploratory conversations on the part of naval officers with their Iranian counterparts regarding the availability of bases in the Indian Ocean during periods of emergency. Indeed, I vaguely recall those conversations. But that is quite different from a commitment, as is implied here, a commitment by the United States to use certain facilities. Commitment's the wrong word. If they were seeking an option on those facilities, that would have been quite appropriate. And I do indeed, I expect that indeed was the case. There were people in the Department of State who had the feeling that the United States should limit its presence in the Indian Ocean, that should emphasize the demilitarization of the Indian Ocean. But that was never the attitude of the Secretary of State. Kissinger, and particularly after the 73 war, strongly supported efforts to establish an appropriate base structure in the Indian Ocean. Diego Garcia was perhaps the most notable example, but it was not well placed with regard to an Indian, with regard to a Persian Gulf conflict. Therefore, we saw it based elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, in May 75, the Shah visited Washington to meet with President Ford and Secretary Kissinger and so forth. Did this visit have any special significance that you can recall?
Well, the significance of the visits, I think, was primarily in terms of getting to know the new American president. I suspect, I do not know if I knew at the time, I've forgotten, that the notion of the visit originated with the Shah, that he had had a close and intimate relationship with Richard Nixon, that he barely knew President Ford, that it was important for him to come visit the United States in order to have a personal relationship with Ford, and to get, I presume he wouldn't want to do, a reiteration of the closeness of the American-Iranian relationship and the backing by the United States for the role of the Shah.
Were there any specific issues discussed within that general context, arms sales issues or otherwise?
I believe that they were. You'll have to remind me of what they were specifically. As you know, the Shah was something of a philosopher of geostrategy, and he spelled out once again, and in more glowing terms, his concerns about what was happening to the northeast of Iran, the dismemberment, the prospective dismemberment of Pakistan, what he feared was growing Soviet domination, as he saw it then, of Afghanistan and the like. And he was very much imbued with his own role as the protector of the region. As we know, during that period, his self-confidence continued to grow, sense of self-importance continued to grow. He had this view of his role as stabilizing the region, although he felt the vulnerabilities of his own country because of Soviet penetrations in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Now, in the course of it, he, of course, was discussed the new equipments that he wanted to have to buttress his position.
Yeah, according to the New York Times article I saw, he wanted to buy four or five Boeing 707s with airborne warning and control systems, as well as A-10 attack bombers and F-14 fighters, a number of each of them.
I'm sorry?
Did you discuss these purchases with you?
What was the list?
Boeing 707s,
right,
with the AWACS.
That was on the list. Uh-huh. What were the others?
A-10 attack bombers,
uh-huh,
as well as F-14 fighters.
Well, of course,
that was already an issue.
The question was of additional F-14s, mm-hmm, and the answer was that there was no problem about that. The A-10s I have less recollection of, but the A-10 was, of course, designed as a close air support aircraft, and if the Shah wanted to buy them, that was fine with us. Indeed, it seemed to us to be more relevant for his purposes than some of the fancier equipment that he normally wanted to buy. The A-10 was not a state-of-the-art aircraft. And finally, the AWACS issue would have caused, as indeed as we can see in retrospect, did cause much greater concern, but the decision of the earlier period indeed continued to prevail. If the Shah wanted to buy four or five AWACSs, he was going to have them.
Did you make any effort? What, did you agree with that, or did you adopt the reservations personally?
Once again, I have very thin memory after all these years, but my recollection is indeed that I made some vague passes of discouraging him, making sure that he understood that these were very expensive equipments. But having done that in a perfunctory way, I think I subsided, but my recollection may be quite wrong on that. Well, it's not quite wrong on that, but my recollection may be a little bit off on that.
The sales all went through, basically.
Mm-hmm. They were going through, and as you know, they reached the peak in the Carter period, and as I recall it, Admiral Turner protested vigorously about the sale of AWACS to the Shah, but it was in the Carter period that these issues came to culmination in the form of contracts. At that time, there were only kind of verbal promises that if indeed you want the AWACS, you can have it.
What was the overall tone of these discussions? Was it fairly friendly? Was there any?
Very friendly.
Okay. Were there any rumors at this time about the Shah's health? The New York Times suggested that there were concerns that he looked weak or not as healthy as he had in earlier years.
Let me say, with regard to the prior question, that I think I mentioned that I was the Shah's host in that period. Because the President Kissinger, for some reason or other, had to go out of town, so I escorted him during his last day here. To his chopper and the like. Now, I do not know whether the Shah might have felt that the new president and the Secretary of State were not giving him his due deference under those conditions. I can only speculate on that since he certainly did not raise the subject with me. But, in regard to friendliness, he may have inferred that that reflected a somewhat scaled down degree of intimacy with the United States as compared with the Nixon period. What was the next question?
Was there any concern for this period? Was there any concern for this period about the Shah's health at all?
No. The Shah at that time looked quite vigorous on the occasion of that visit. I think that in 1978, none of us knew of the nature of the Shah's ailment, even though he had been treated by French doctors. Some wondering why we didn't know that he had been treated by French doctors. In 1978, Blumenthal, for example, who had known the Shah for many years, visited there, and I think it was late October, early November of 78, and he was shaken by the Shah's appearance. But I think that he attributed it more to the political conditions and the shock that these political conditions have had on the Shah's well-being than to any serious health conditions. So in 75, there was no...
The only reason I mentioned, there was an article in the Times I saw in that year suggesting that Shah looked drawn and worn compared to earlier periods. So that was interesting to see that. Okay, now apparently I read sometime in the summer of 75, General Tufani, there was a report that he had plans to develop tank production capacities in Iran. tank building factory. Did they ever discuss these plans with you, that they wanted to...
I don't recall. As I mentioned last time, the administration was inclined to back activities in terms of co-production. I do not positively recall that, but we would have had no objection to that. As you know, there was talk of Bell Helicopter about co-production. There was talk about co-production of the TOW missile. I would have been much more concerned about that because of the greater sophistication of the technology. And I resisted the TOW missile co-production, though unsuccessfully. If the Shah had wanted to produce tanks, we would not have thought it. So I have no recollection of that.
Yeah.
That was the kind of thing that we preferred to sell directly for balance of payments reasons.
Right. Now, last time you mentioned the study that Glenn Plotkin did of Iran and arms sales, basically. And I read in Gary Sick's book that you took that report and used it as a basis for a letter to President Ford requesting an NSC review of arms sales to the Shah and Persian Gulf countries generally, apparently.
Well, I don't recall precisely what I did at that time. I certainly was sufficiently concerned about the evolution of U.S.-Iranian relations that I made representations to the White House during 1975. To what extent that reflected the views of Dick Callaghan, the concern that we had about getting a special defense representative in country, to what extent it represented the report by itself. All of these things were reflected in a broad concern within the department that we put relations with Iran on a systematic basis rather than simply following what I'll call the visceral impulses of the Shah.
Now, Sick also suggests that Henry Kissinger stalled on any effort to get a response to this request for an NSC study. Does that ring a bell, or?
Well, that certainly rings a bell, because there was an extended period of no response. It was not the sort of thing that Kissinger welcomed in general, and more particularly, even for those things about which he felt neutral, he normally delayed consideration as a way of building up bargaining position and political capital for a future negotiation. So I do recall that Henry was not immediately responsive, but that was par for the course.
So Sick suggests that this is part of an overall struggle for power and influence between you and Kissinger. This Iran issue was just one facet of that. Is that a possible?
Well, I think that over-dramatized it. I think that we had different views on a number of subjects. In the case of... I tended to react to particular issues at the time of the fall of the Greek colonels or in relation to what was going on in Iran. And it was specific issues that worried me. Kissinger may, intended to do things in this manner, he may have regarded this as part of a broad-based struggle for power. Certainly not in my view. To the extent that there was a competition for influence, I tended to be primarily concerned about maintaining control within the Department of Defense and to influence the arms control talks with the Soviet Union, which impacted directly on the central mission of the Department of Defense. In these other areas, they were really much more episodic and treated as part of a struggle for power is to make it far more grand than is actually the case. There may have been much more of a struggle for power, competition for influence, I would prefer to say, in the issue of U.S.-Soviet relations as it impacted on arms control, but that would be the end of it. That was the central concern that I had in this.
Now, one project that emerged in the mid-70s was the IVEX project, which was to increase the capacity to monitor Soviet military activities from stations in Iran. Now, I've read that that there was some controversy over this project. Do you recall the nature of the debate?
Was the CIA project?
I think it was basically a CIA project. I'm not really sure.
Indeed, there is controversy, but I don't plan to discuss it.
Was it more technical controversy or technical issues related to it, or more
it was,
a political
it was,
issue?
It was basically cost effectiveness issues. I do not. And questions of U.S. arms people and the appropriateness of the equipment that they might be selling and so forth. There may have been some bureaucratic conflict too, though I don't recall the nature.
Okay.
But the central questions, as I recall, are the cost effectiveness issues and the disagreements management issues.
I bet it was finally abandoned. Was that under Ford or later on, this whole project?
You'll have to ask somebody at the agency.
Yeah. Okay. Now, during the mid-70s, the Shah's human rights policy also became a matter of public debate. Now, within the Nixon and Ford administrations, was there much concern expressed internally in private discussions about the Shah's policies towards the domestic opponents?
Not very much. That was unfashionable. It would certainly have elicited a contemptuous guffaw during the Nixon years. Ford would have been more inclined to be more sensitive to the domestic political repercussions. To the extent that we have domestic displays or stories that we might have been more sensitive to that, we would not have been inclined to scoff at the issue as would have been Nixon's hands. But he certainly did not pick it up, so far as I know.
Now, in the meetings with the Shah, did he discuss these charges with officials? Did he complain about members of Congress making accusations and so forth?
I think only indirectly.
Yeah.
It was not a central concern. Ford was very much guided in these matters by Kissinger. He did not regard himself as an authority on foreign policy issues. Kissinger certainly retained the most favorable attitude towards the Shah. Consequently, the Shah would not be harassed by anyone within the administration. There was no Bureau of Human Rights or whatever the devil is called in the State Department. And expressions on Capitol Hill tended to come from liberal Democrats, those who were regarded as leftist Democrats, and they were simply brushed off. And I do not recall any specific conversations, but I'm sure if the subject came up, that he would have had the reaction of, oh, that's X, and he's always off on some leftist line, don't pay any attention to him.
Okay. Now, we'll move on to the Carter period. Maybe in January 77, President Carter appointed you a special assistant for energy affairs. Later, you became Department of Energy Secretary. Now, during this period?
As assistant to the president, with primary responsibility to manage the affairs, but dealt with other issues if they have to interest the president.
During this early period of 77, 78, were you involved in any issues concerning Iran or OPEC, the Shah and OPEC?
Yes, indeed. Although our relations with the Shah over OPEC matters were rather touchy, because the Shah tended to be, had been the hawk on pricing, and he preferred to work with the Saudis, because the Saudis had tended to resist the more aggressive moves with regard to OPEC pricing. Saudis tended, we encouraged the Saudis to resist the requests for higher prices, and the Saudis tended to do so. OPEC issues tended to be back burner issues during that period. The price of oil remained stabilized at about roughly $13 a barrel. The problems with OPEC began to arise as the Shah was falling. And under those circumstances, they were both secondary, and they were hardly things that one would discuss with the Shah. So the brief answer is no, we didn't talk about OPEC matters. What was the other thing?
What is it?
Well, we didn't discuss extensively, or we always refer to the price of oil.
I read that when the Shah visited Washington in the fall of 77, that he made some sort of agreement to try to get OPEC to hold the line on any further price increases. I guess, you know, President Carter asked him to go along with this. Do you recall?
Yeah, I recall that, but it was not the central line of our efforts, obviously, when you run into a major oil producer during the conversations that you will, Mr. Carter was inclined to do, touch all bases. And he would say, I hope you'll hold the line on prices. As I've indicated, it was not a serious problem in 1977. By 78, it became a serious problem, but that was because the Shah himself was falling, and it was not the central issue of our relationship to him, and he had little control over the problem. The approximate cause of the rise in oil prices in late 78 and 79 was the strike of the oil field workers in Iran against the Shah, which he would dearly have liked to have been able to sell, but was not in a position to do so. What was the other issue that you raised?
I think there wasn't one, but I was going to ask how you would characterize President Carter's general approach to the Shah and Iran during the year and a half or so before the revolution erupted.
Ambivalent. The curious thing about it was that he had an ambivalence towards the Shah that continued throughout Shah's period. Throughout the Shah's tenure, but the public expression of that ambivalence grew less and less as the Shah got into greater trouble. And he began to talk glowingly of the Shah, and as I recall, it visited Iran in the beginning of 1978 and said some glowing things about the Shah. That shouldn't have been taken too seriously, because Carter tended to say glowing things about whomever he was visiting while he was visiting us. But Carter had deep, deep concerns about the human rights issue, in contrast to Nixon, who would have scoffed at them, and Ford, who paid little attention to them and would be encouraged not to pay any attention to them by Kissinger. Kissinger was not known to be a crusader on human rights.
But did you get the sense that Carter was actually putting pressure on the Shah to liberalize? Or was it more indirect and subtle? Or?
I don't know the answer to that, because I was not privy to the most intimate conversations between him and the Shah. Shaw, it is not beyond Jimmy Carter to press his case directly. But the Shaw clearly heard that of central concern to the new president of the United States was the issue of human rights. Because that was something that Carter tended to talk about almost every time he spoke publicly. And that in his quest to accommodate the incoming president of the United States, with whom he hoped to get along, that the Shah would take into account that this was a central concern in general, would apply it to his own country, and thus attempted to ameliorate human rights conditions as a way of propitiating Carter, even if Carter never asked him to do it directly. I do not know whether he did or he didn't. I suspect, given Carter's nature, that he could not refrain from at least a hint in that direction in his private conversations, but that he would have regarded as inappropriate to indulge in a harangue on the issue.
In terms of, say, fundamental policy, the basics of policy, in terms of the basics of policy, fundamental policy, was there any really major shift away from the policy support that Kissinger had articulated, the basic policy supporting the Shah's tenure in Iran?
I don't think that there was a basic shift away, if you mean a change in policy.
Yeah.
However, the Shah was viewed with much greater skepticism than he had been previously, and he knew it. And that even though there was not any declaration of a shift, the policy had indeed shifted, because instead of all-out backing as our chosen instrument in the area, we would have an attitude of, this is our ally, he is important in the region, but he himself has serious political flaws to answer for. That would be the attitude of the Carter people. And it follows from Carter's long-term, consistent, deeply felt stress on human rights. The surprising thing was that he kept that under control as much as he did during the last days of the Shah.
Now, as you know, the revolution broke out in the fall of 78, and on November 6th, the Shah declared a martial law government in Iran.
Now, I remember that very
well. What was your initial reaction to this emerging situation?
My initial reaction to the emerging situation was primary concern about pushing the energy legislation through the Congress, which preoccupied me until the fall of 1978.
This is the bill to create the Department of Energy?
No, that had passed
okay.
Early in 1977. This was the National Energy Act, which consisted of five legislative parts. During much of the spring and summer of 1978, I had spent endless hours up there on the hill trying to move the Natural Gas Act as a component of the National Energy Act, trying to move each house and so forth. So my time was more or less devoted to those activities. I had little enough time to devote to it. I did receive a letter from one of my former subordinates in the DOD, Fritz Kramer, in March or April, which said, in his cryptic style, "Sir, Colin, the Shah is in mortal peril. Yours sincerely, F.G.A. Kramer." I often cited that later on as indicating that the developments in Iran were not so obscure as some in the U.S. intelligence community might have wanted to pretend. But towards the end of summer, beginning with the developments with the fire in Abadan in September. Somewhere then I began to devote an increasing part of my time to the developments in Iran. As the legislation finally passed, just before my trip to China, which started in October, about October the 15th, was devoting substantial time, and I had the entire resources of the international arm of the Department of Energy to work with, and the Assistant Secretary for International Affairs, Harry Burgold, was devoting most of his energies to monitoring developments in Iran for me. I mention this because in his book, Gary Six suggests that the Department of Energy did not have the staff or manpower to handle these kinds of things. It had a hell of a lot more manpower than did the NSC staff. They're not as intimately related, but manpower or staff problems were never a source of difficulty for us.
There were people in Tehran that could report to you what was going on? Energy Department people?
No, I was following the intelligence.
Okay.
Burgold was picking up the gossip on a daily basis. Now, we left around October the 20th, I would guess, for China. During the trip to China, of course, there were only occasional opportunities to look at the press and to note that the difficulties in Tehran were increasing. The difficulties throughout Iran were increasing. I believe that by then that the oil fields were pretty well shut down, and there was deep concern. When the Shah declared martial law, it was on a day that we were flying north, I believe, into what the Chinese now call the northeast, what we refer to as Manchuria. And we devoted the day, several hours during that day, to considering the implications of that development. I had the desire, and I expressed it at the time, to take the government aircraft which we were using and just fly directly to Tehran, because I was the only official in the U.S. government that traced back to the Nixon years and had the one who had the longest personal association with the Shah, just to buck up the Shah under those circumstances. I did not follow that inclination because I could not, in a sense. I had the President, Carter, had agreed to delay the official signing of the National Energy Acts, all five of them, until I returned for the signing ceremony. And that took place, if I recall the date, on November the 9th, 1978, and I had to be back here for that signing ceremony, and obviously could not, under those circumstances, go Tehran, but I was strongly tempted to do so because I felt, without having seen the Shah, that he needed bucking up under the circumstances, that the Shah tended to be quite timid, and that he would need to be encouraged by the Americans, that once having declared martial law, that he should back real martial law. He did not do so. He put in place a general who was not decisive, who indeed promptly had a heart attack, and throughout the period, that official period of martial law, it was plain that the Shah didn't have his heart in it, and that as a result, the martial law kind of backfired. When I returned to the United States from the day I landed here, my principal concern was attempting to preserve the Shah's regime, in the course of which I visited with all of the principal advisors, political advisors to the president. I had extensive conversations with Kaczynski. I attended many of the National Security Council meetings on the subject. Yeah, Kaczynski brought me in more or less as a supporter. I talked to all of Carter's principals. I talked to Jordan Powell. I talked to the lawyer from Atlanta who was his great enemy.
Kerbo?
Who?
Kerbo?
Yeah, Charlie Kerbo.
Yeah.
I talked to Charlie Kerbo. Charlie Kerbo, to say the least, had less of a geopolitical sense than any man that I've encountered. And all that he was concerned about was whether they were going to go and have to be gasoline rations, as you put it. And I tried to convince all of them, and was successful with Jordan Powell, that the president had to realize that what the political stakes were for him. I recognized by that time that one could not. Thank you.